Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. Earlier today, North Korea said it successfully conducted a missile test Sunday, supervised by leader Kim Jong-un. UN Security Council scheduled to meet on Tuesday. U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley, appearing on the ABC program this week, said the pressure on the North Korean leader will increase.
What we're going to do is continue to tighten the screws. He feels it. He absolutely feels it. And we're going to continue, whether it's sanctions, whether it's press statements. What we do know is the international community is concerned. It's not just us against them anymore. Now you're going to see the entire international community isolate North Korea and let them know this is not acceptable.
Haley also said such behavior is not the way to earn a meeting with President Trump, who had earlier indicated a willingness to meet Kim. Governments bracing for more last week's cyber attack that hit more than 150 countries. Attack took place Friday, exploiting vulnerabilities in older Microsoft operating systems. Mark Weatherford is chief cyber strategist for the data security company VArmor.
This has been one of the challenges that we in the industry have faced for decades, really, and that is as updates and patches are released by the software vendors, the expectation is that these will be deployed as quickly as possible. But it isn't always that easy. I mean, there's a lot of testing that typically has to be done.
Microsoft called the attack a wake-up call to governments not to store malware that can be stolen. The company believes it was taken from the U.S. government's National Security Agency. Also in the news, armed militias targeting Muslims in a remote Central African Republic town killed at least 30 civilians as well as six United Nations peacekeepers. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said he's outraged by the attacks, which may constitute a war crime. This is VOA News. At least 1,500 Syrian rebels and their families abandoned another long-held district just outside of the capital, Damascus, as the army of President Bashar al-Assad and its allies pushed to seize full control of the capital and surrounding areas for the first time in nearly 5 years. Stephen Zunis is a Middle East scholar at the University of San Francisco.
The Damascus regime is consolidating its control over the areas around greater Damascus. One of the big setbacks for the rebels was the fighting among themselves, among the moderate and Islamist factions. And for those who were part of the initial uprising, which began nonviolently in southern Syria, this is particularly tragic.
As civil war raged near the capital, Kurdish-led Syrian forces far to the north pressed a separate offensive against Islamic State extremists just outside the de facto IS capital, Raqqa. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has acknowledged U.S.-Russia relations are at a low point. Appearing on the NBC program Meet the Press, Tillerson said President Trump believes it is important to re-engage with Moscow.
It's in the interest of the American people, it's in the interest of Russia, the rest of the world, that we do something to see if we cannot improve the relationship between the two greatest nuclear powers in the world. So the president, I think, is committed to at least make an effort in that regard, and he has certainly asked me to make an important effort as well.
Tillerson said it remains to be seen whether efforts to improve ties will bear true fruit, that is. On another matter, Tillerson said Mr. Trump is trying to see how he can move the U.S. embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem without adversely affecting the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. 17 prisoners have been shot and killed after a mass breakout at a jail in Papua New Guinea. Reports indicate another 57 are on the run. It's the same prison where police shot dead 12 inmates during a jailbreak last year. Crime and lawlessness in PNG, a nation where many still live in traditional subsistence lives in remote areas, is rampant. Search is underway for a new director of the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation after President Trump fired James Comey last week. The administration has interviewed at least 8 candidates for the job. An NBC Wall Street Journal poll released on Sunday found 29% of Americans approved of the Comey firing, while 78% support an independent commission or special prosecutor to investigate Russia's interference in the election, which the FBI was investigating under Comey's leadership. Get more on the VOA mobile app.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty, Washington. Today is Monday, May 15th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sudan's president will attend a regional meeting next week with President Trump, but the opposition says he does not deserve to be there.
We think this is very provocative to the victims of the genocide in Darfur. Al-Bashir is still wanted to the ICC for 10 counts, including genocide in Darfur. And those victims are still waiting for the international community to help in arresting Al-Bashir.
Abdelaziz Sam is a member of the Sudan Liberation Movement faction led by Mini Minawi. Sudan's information minister hopes U.S. President Trump will lift the remaining U.S. sanctions on Sudan. Burundian farmers called on their government to lift food exportation ban, and Ivory Coast military moves to put down an army mutiny.
They have taken the city of Bouaké, which is the second town of the country. The mutiny is kind of violent because two or three persons have been killed so far in Bouaké, and the government have decided to force them to put their arms down.
Jean-Gervais Chaide is the vice president in charge of finance and budget for former President Gbagbo's party and the first in a series of public opinion polls about Liberia's 2017 presidential election has been released. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley's post in our Listener of the Day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sudan's Minister of Information has confirmed that President Omar al-Bashir will attend a meeting of regional Arab leaders with U.S. President Donald Trump this week in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Ahmed Bilal says this is a realization that the United States and the international community recognizes the important role that Sudan plays in the fight against global terrorism. He brushes aside criticism by the rebel Sudan People's Liberation Movement that President Bashir is an indicted war criminal and should not be given such an international platform.
Everybody knows that the role of Sudan is very crucial in the area, in Africa, in the Arab region, and we are cooperating with actually the international community in fighting the terrorism and our intelligence and cooperating also with others in this respect, and everybody knows that. About the attending of the President Bashir, he will be there. I can't make sure that whether he can meet Trump or not, but he is, will attend there. We are actually a part of the allies against terrorism in Saudi Arabia and other countries, so Sudan will be there.
Yes, Mr. Minister, your critics, the SPLM North, they are saying while you are fighting terrorism, you are also waging terrorist war against your own people. What do you say to that?
Actually, this is just allegations. They used to repeat these things. And actually, they are making going on war in spite of the suffering of the people in South Sudan and suffering of the people in these areas. They are calling it liberated areas. They are, in spite of that, they are keeping on. They are refusing any sort of calls for peace, any calls for negotiations. I think we are making every chance we are calling for peace. We have done the national dialogue, and we are today, we started the government after the national debate and this thing. So I think now everybody is for peace. Nobody is calling for war except Yasser Arafat.
Mr. Minister, before President Barack Obama left office, he started to ease some sanctions against your government. Let's say President Bashir meets with President Trump. What do you think he might want to say to him? Does he want to tell President Trump to erase the rest of the sanctions against your country?
I think the partial lifting of the sanctions by President Obama, and they have given actually 6 months to review it again and to raise it completely. And according to the CIA now report and other parts of the other authorities in the USA, they are saying that he's very cooperative and he has done everything to convince others that he's not hosting terrorism. He is actually against terrorism, and they are recommending for lifting the sanctions from Sudan. Actually, I'm quite astonished that some Sudanese, like Yasser Arman, is still calling for the sanctions not to be lifted. And everybody knows that sanctions, who pays the bill is not the government, but the Sudanese people. And I think now USA administration is, I think they are very quite convinced that these sanctions should be raised. And we are expecting that when President Bashir meets Trump, this will be a final date for the sanctions and it will be arranged.
Mr. Minister, you are always kind and thank you very much for talking with me.
You are welcome.
Hakim Bilal, Sudan's Information Minister, he was speaking with me from the capital, Khartoum. A member of the Sudan Liberation Movement faction led by Mini Minawi says that President Omar al-Bashir should not be allowed to attend a meeting of regional Arab leaders with U.S. President Donald Trump this week in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. President Trump is expected to meet with leaders from Islamic countries this week to discuss cooperation in the fight against global terrorism. But Abdulaziz Sam, a member of the Sudan Liberation Movement faction led by Mini Minawi, says President Bashir should not be allowed to attend because he is an indicted war criminal who should be arrested rather than be given such an international platform.
We think this is very provocative to the victims of the genocide in Darfur. Al-Bashir is still wanted to the ICC for 10 counts, including genocide in Darfur. And those victims are still waiting for the international community to help in arresting Al-Bashir, not to host him in like this council. Secondly, it is still the violations of the international humanitarian law, of the human rights laws. The violation by the regime of al-Bashir Ali is still going on. I don't know what's new, why, and all the world was abandoning him and stopping him from coming on these forums. But now what's new? As victims of genocide, we want to know what is new to make al-Bashir come on board the international community and meet with the others.
So what do you think about the idea that the United States and Sudan are now engaged in some kind of rapprochement based on the shared interest of fighting terrorism? And Sudan has been cooperating with the United States.
The Sudan regime itself is a terrorism regime. So how they can help in fighting or eradicating terrorism? They are themselves are exercising terrorism against all the Sudanese except themselves. So I don't think that Sudan is a good partner for fighting against any terrorism, since it is itself is a terrorism regime. That's why we think that the world is still under a moral and legal obligation not to host these fugitives, this who is just escaping from justice. We should not support impunity. Al-Bashir should go to the ICC, not to the meeting of Islamic or anything leaders with President Trump. I think President Trump should just not go to this step. Al-Bashir is still terrorist. He is killing people in Darfur, in Nuba Mountains and Blue Nile. He is the one who collapsed the economy of the Sudan. He is one who is allocating more than 80% of the income of Sudan, the budget, for killing the people of Sudan. So how this man should be honored?
Before he left office, President Barack Obama eased some sanctions on Sudan, and there are indications that the Trump administration may want to continue this kind of cooperation between Sudan and the United States.
We know that decrees or executive orders that signed by President Barack Obama. But even if the U.S. had its own benefits or its own programs in where they think that Sudan is useful in providing them with information against the Islamic extremists and terrorists. But internally, internal Sudan, the conflict of Sudan that caused by this regime of al-Bashir, which killed millions of people and displaced them in Darfur, and now it is killing and displacing the same genocidal war in the Nuba Mountains and in Blue Nile, and even in Khartoum, people are not in safety against this regime. So they have to take into consideration the internal situation of the Sudan and how this regime is killing the people, and it is people in Khartoum. There is no free press, no media, no everything. So how they are going to bring this regime to the others and present them as if they are good regime and good government? No, they are not good.
Abdulaziz Sam is a member of the Sudan Liberation Movement faction led by Mini Minawi. He was speaking with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Today's Monday, May 15th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. Burundian farmers are calling on their government to lift the ban on food exportation to neighboring countries. The government banned food exportation last year as part of a food security precaution. Moses Havyarimana reports from Bujumbura.
East African countries, including Burundi and Tanzania, had temporarily suspended the exportation of food to the neighboring countries in August 2016. The measure was as a precaution to overcome food insecurity during the prolonged dry season. Tanzania lifted the ban on their food export in September last year, but Burundi is yet to follow. Andre Nahishakye is a farmer in Cibitoki province located in the northwestern Burundi. He says sometimes people had to lease their land for agriculture production, but now they can't even afford it because they don't even know where they will sell the harvest, let alone paying the bank loans. Mr. Nahishakye started farming back in 1993 and now harvesting at least 100 tons of fruits every year. There's extremely high competition and high production between the farmers in Burundi for the small market in Bujumbura with a low demand. This signifies the depreciation of the fruit and vegetable prices, hence resulting to Inca losses for both farmers and traders. Nahishakye says that it is a big problem for them and that he is finding a way of going to the bank and ask for forgiveness and give them what he has since he can't pay up the loan that he received. Bank loans is one of the major concerns currently for the local farmers in Burundi, as many have been devastated by the prolonged dry season and low demand in the market. Gloriose Nibarutai is the spokesperson of Burundi Ministry of Trade.
You know that the ban is still ongoing because you know that the country has faced the climate change issues. The government had decided to ban the export of agricultural products to the nearby countries. The government expects to remove the ban because now the crops are growing. I think that at any moment they can remove the ban.
East African partner states sell about 20% of their exports in the East African Community Market. Most of the fruits and vegetables in Rwanda were imported from Burundi. The two countries' relation has continued to deteriorate since 2015. Two Burundians were killed by the Rwandan army while smuggling in food last year. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Cibitoki in Burundi.
Ivory Coast military on Sunday began an offensive against mutinous soldiers in Bouake, the country's second largest city. The soldiers, most of them former rebel fighters who fought to bring President Alassane Ouattara to power, have been demanding the balance of their bonus payments. Jean-Gervais Tchéide is the vice president in charge of finance and budget for former President Gbagbo's party.
What is happening is that those rebels who helped Mr. Ouattara to come to power are now claiming some money that Mr. Ouattara had promised to give them before they started their rebellion. So since January 2017, they started mutiny to have their money. Now, the governor gave them 5 million CFA and promised to give 7 million again, so a total of 12 million each military. Now, they are claiming the 7 million remaining. They have taken the city of Bouake, which is the second town of the country. The mutiny is kind of violent because two or three persons have been killed so far in Bouake, and the government have decided to force them to put their arms down. I know that the army has launched an operation to disarm the mutiny, and we are waiting to see what will happen.
The defense minister is saying that the military will not negotiate with the renegade troops. What do you make of that as an opposition person?
Well, this is the official statement, but in fact, they are negotiating. Right now, negotiations are going on in Bouake between the army chief of staff or his representatives and the mutants. But as an opposition party, what we say is that when you take mercenaries to give you the official power, sooner or later, you will be in trouble. This is what we are witnessing now. Mr. Ouattara took mercenaries all over the region, the western region of Africa, to overthrow Mr. Gbagbo. And after doing that, he thought that everything would be going smoothly. No, never, never. When you make a putsch with the mercenaries, don't be surprised that sooner or later, even if you give them the money that we have you have promised, when they finish that money, they will come back again to ask you for more money. And that is what is going on.
Doesn't the government have the money to pay, or it just doesn't want to pay the mutiny soldier?
The money that the mutiny soldiers are claiming is too much. The government has no means to pay that money. Imagine 12 million per person and multiply that by 20,000 military. How much? In a country like Cote d'Ivoire, it is impossible to pay. So they started to pay, and they understand that they cannot continue paying. And they try now to have a rude language and to threaten them and to say that there will be no more negotiations. But it is too late. They should never have started to pay military mutants. No, they should remain firm and try to push down that rebellion. It is a rebellion into a rebellion.
Politically, Mr. Chaide, where are things in terms of the opposition?
For the time being, there is no threat on the opposition leaders. It is just a question between the government and their mercenaries that they took in the army. So we are not concerned. But the problem is that the population is victim of this situation. Because for 3 days now, the populations of Bouaké cannot go out of their houses. They are remaining indoors. So we imagine the problem that can cause. The children who can be sick or something cannot go to hospitals. Women cannot go to the market to make food for their children. Things like that. That is the problem. Apart from that, there is no problem in Abidjan. We are here.
Jean-Gervais Chaide is the vice president in charge of finance and budget for former President Laurent Gbagbo's party. He was speaking with me from the Ivorian capital, Abidjan. The first in a series of public opinion polls about Liberia's 2017 presidential election has been released. The poll was conducted by the Liberia Holding Consortium. The principal of the consortium, Abdoulaye Camara, said the poll considered key population areas in 8 of Liberia's 15 counties over a 10-day period. Camara says the results show Vice President Joseph Boakai as the lead candidate, followed by Coalition for Democratic Change George Weah and Liberty Party's Charles Bramski from a list of 7 candidates.
The survey is generally prospective, taking on a sample scale of a limited number of persons representing the whole, and it was ranged to 8 of Liberia's 15 counties. The intention is to ensure that citizens have an idea of the issues that concern the election and also the people who are relevant as far as the elections are concerned.
So can you give us just a quick breakdown in terms of who the voters, according to your survey, favor?
At this point, a total of 29.45% of the respondents favor the current Vice President Joseph Boakai. The next candidate of relevance is George Weah from the Coalition of Democratic Change with 22.16%, followed by Charles Johnson of the Liberty Party with 16%.
The support you mentioned of Vice President Boakai, is this national or is this regional?
The figures I gave earlier were actually national. The survey results are actually broken down into the 6 counties where it was conducted. For Magibi and Lofa County, Vice President Boakai holds larger percentages there. For instance, in Magibi County, the survey shows him at 40.9%, and in Lofa County, it shows him at 58.57%. George Weah has the percentage in Montserrado at 42.5%, and in Grand Gida at 55%. Mr. Brunson has the higher percentage in Grand Basel with 46.6%.
According to your survey, are there any particular issues on the minds of these voters?
Yes, a segment of the survey actually asked the respondents about what were their concerns. Overall, more persons were concerned about education than anything else. We actually asked respondents to provide 3 issues that were of most concern to them. Of 720 concerns that were listed, 155 of them were on education, 125 on health issues, 90 on job, 88 on road, and 49 on agriculture.
So how did you conduct this survey? Did you do it by radio? Did you do it by handout? Did you write out questions for people? And along those lines, may I ask, did you talk to people in the rural areas of the country?
Yes, it was done by handout. It was paper-based. And same questions given in 8 counties, just about the same time, over a 10-day period. There are no questions consider a number of different things. What are people concerned about? What are their impressions about the government and their expectation? Who do they think will make a good president and also a vice president? For the presidential, we had a list of 7 persons, 6 candidates that we have seen with a given degree of organization, and we used a 7th candidate who happened to have been the only woman in the list of candidates so far for president.
Abdullahi Kamara is the principal of the Liberia Holding Consortium. He was speaking with me from the Liberian capital, Monrovia. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good morning to you, James. We begin with the results of the first leg of matches played at the weekend in the CAF Confederations Cup. Title holders TP Mazembe of the Democratic Republic of Congo made a winning Group D debut on Sunday by defeating CF Mwanana of Gabon 2-0 in Lubumbashi. In the other Group D game played on Friday, SuperSport United of South Africa and Haroya of Guinea drew 2-2 in Pretoria. A penalty and an own goal helped Club African of Tunisia to a 3-1 Group A victory over Rivers United of Nigeria in raids on Sunday. Former Confederation Cup winners FCUS Rabat of Morocco lead Club African on goal difference after a comfortable 3-0 home win over KCCA of Uganda late on Saturday. Platinum Stars of South Africa and Mouloudia Elja of Algeria played a dull 1-1 Group B draw before a small crowd in the mining town of Rotenburg. Platinum and Mouloudia are 2 points behind record 3-time winners CS Faxien of Tunisia, who overcame Mbabane Swallows of Swaziland, Recreativo Libolo of Angola, top Group C, with Zesco United of Zambia after a dramatic 1-0 home victory over Al Hilal Obied of Sudan. The second leg of the fixtures is set for May 23rd and 24th. Now to the 2017 African Cup of Nations Under 17 competition, which began in Gabon on Sunday. Guinea hammered host Gabon 5-1 in the opening match at the Stade Port-Gentil on Sunday evening. The win sees the Junior National Elephants top Group A after receiving the maximum points against the Junior Panthers, who are rooted at the bottom of the group without a point. In the second match of the day, Ghana's Black Starlets kicked off their campaign with a 4-0 thrashing of Cameroon. In today's games, Mali will take on Tanzania while Angola will face Niger. And on to athletics, where Ethiopia's Liul Gebrselassie won the 10-kilometer 2017 Opepe International Road Race in Edo State, South Nigeria. Gebrselassie finished in 29 minutes, 26 seconds to also clinch the top prize of $15,000. His compatriot, Jemiel Bekele, finished second in 29 minutes, 34 seconds, while Tanzanian's Ismail Jumar ended in third position with 32 minutes, 22 seconds. In the female category, Azamara Gabru completed the race in 33 minutes, 59 seconds and took the top prize of $15,000 and was followed by another Kenyan, Veronica Maina, who finished in 34 minutes, 19 seconds to win $10,000. Timbili Jimeli completed the Kenyan sweep in third, completing the race in 34 minutes, 39 seconds to win $7,000. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, May 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good week.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, what does the future hold for Liberia? Who will lead the West African nation when President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf leaves office in October at the end of her second term? 2 million Liberians have registered to vote, and nearly half of those are women. What's at stake in Liberia? On the next Straight Talk Africa at 1830 UTC.